Jack Rakove is W.R. Coe Professor of History and American Studies and Professor of Political Science at Stanford University, where he has taught since 1980. His writings focus on the revolutionary origins of American constitutionalism, the political thought and career of James Madison, and the role of history in constitutional adjudication and politics. But Jack has not hesitated to jump into the fray of recent political controversies, from the impeachment of Clinton to recent Supreme Court cases regarding Guantanamo detainees. Jack is the author of four books, including Original Meanings, Politics and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution, which won the Pulitzer Prize and is for sale in our gift shop, and the editor of four others, including James Madison Writings and the Unfinished Election of 2000. So please welcome Jack Rakove.
Thank you. This being Martin Luther King Day, I thought I would introduce my remarks on how to think about presidential power in the post-9/11 period with a just very brief reference to Dr. King's career. I think many of us will recall that just prior to his death in 1968, the spring of 1968, Dr. King had been moving from being a civil rights leader into becoming something of an anti-war leader. Indeed, it's one of the most interesting passages in Martin Luther King's career to see how his politics at the national level developed in this way. I was thinking about that evolution somewhat in the context of the just concluded hearings over Judge Alito's nomination to join the Supreme Court. You know, one of the interesting things about this hearing is I think everyone would have predicted, was that the future of Roe v. Wade and the woman's right to choose and the right to abortion would be one obvious point of departure, one major source of concern. Given everything we know about the politics of Supreme Court appointments over the last generation, there's no surprise here. What I think is more striking, what I think better anticipates the future, is the number of questions that were directed to Judge Alito having to do with questions of executive power. And in particular, executive power either in wartime or in a time of national emergency such as we believe we've been in since the attacks of September 11th. So I'd like to make that tension, I think, or the idea that the constitutional concerns that have preoccupied us, especially when we think about the Supreme Court for the past 20 years or so, are now moving into an entirely new and somewhat problematic realm where it seems to me the most important set of questions the nation's going to face for the foreseeable future will really be questions about the extent of executive power in times of national emergency, how much authority can the president claim in times like these. And what I want to do is suggest that there have been two very broad views of executive power, which we've inherited from the 18th century, I think not quite from the period of the immediate period of the adoption of the Constitution. That's to say, not from 1787, 1788 so much as from 1793. But there have been two very broad views of executive power, which for whom the principal spokesmen, in fact, were James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, those two collaborators in the adoption of the Constitution. The dispute that broke out between them in 1793, in curious ways, still informs and shapes and defines how we think about this question today. And I think these are the issues we're going to have to come back and confront. Indeed, we are confronting them now, and Judge Alito's nomination has been the most immediate, but by no means the only focus for this issue, even over the past few weeks. So what are those views, and how can we think about them historically, and how can I explain why the issues that vex us now are so deeply rooted in our nation's history, going back more or less to its beginning? Well, one view of executive power, the one that's been propounded by the administration and for which I think Vice President Cheney, probably more than President Bush, has been the leading spokesman, runs something like this. It says that the American presidency, or what's now being called the unitary presidency, was created to promote vigorous executive leadership, and that the executive power, which the very first sentence of Article II vests in the President of the United States, that executive power is a plenary grant of authority. It is ample. It's capacious. It includes a large measure of executive discretion, even perhaps including some right to, if not to disregard the commands of Congress or the president's obligation to take care of that the laws be faithfully executed, gives the president broad discretion, broad latitude, a very high degree of autonomy in interpreting just just how those laws are to be enforced, so of all armed forces, of the Army and the Navy, and now, of course, the Air Force as well. One manifestation of this, discussed as recently as this morning's New York Times, is the idea that is this curious procedure, which has deep roots in the nation's history, of the president issuing signing statements, offering his view of what legislation means almost as soon as it's going to take effect. And those of you who have been following this issue closely will know that the whole status of the McCain Amendment relating to torture or the Kyle Graham Levin Amendment relating to the legal rights of the Guantanamo detainees is something which, in the signing statement of last Friday to the Defense Authorization Bill, the administration is claiming broad authority to interpret in its own way, and possibly in a way that would really subvert the compromises worked out in Congress to get the legislation through. Against that view of discretionary executive power, which I would say is essentially a Hamiltonian view of the nature of the executive, is a different conception with which I would associate, among others, primarily James Madison. This view says that one has to go to the text of the Constitution, one has to look very carefully at the allocation of authority between the president and Congress, even in the realm of war, even in the realm of national security. That when one does that, one should come up with a view of the presidency which emphasizes above all the president's obligation, the president's duty, to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The language of Article II. This says that there is no broad discretionary authority invested in the presidency, and certainly not a kind of authority that might be compared to the prerogative of the British monarch of the 18th century. This says that the presidency is constrained. It says that the whole point of the vesting clause, saying the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States, is not to create a vast grant of plenary executive power. It's to say that a single individual is ultimately responsible for discharging that power. And responsibility here means not only to do so effectively, but also to do so in conformity to the laws and the Constitution of the United States. Recalling that the president takes an oath to take, the president's oath of office says he shall preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States first and foremost. So these are two views of executive power. I think that really the first great debate about in which they're manifested took place not at the time the Constitution was adopted, but 5 years later, a short distance, but still a significant one, in a famous debate of 1793. The occasion which was President Washington's issuance of a neutrality proclamation in the war that had just broken out between France, revolutionary France, and the reactionary European monarchies. I don't want to stress that debate. What I want to try to explain is why I think the administration's position represents a constitutional myth, why, as a matter of history, it is fundamentally false and fundamentally wrong and fundamentally misreads the history of our political tradition down to 1788, 1789. But if it's a constitutional myth, it's also a profound political reality. And it may well be that what the Constitution really means in operation, in practice, has very little to do with what the framers thought they were adopting or what the ratifiers thought they were assenting to in 1787, 1788. It may well be that Hamilton is a much better reader of the Constitution, or let's say a much shrewder student of executive power than Madison. But I think posing the issue in this way will offer us, and I think offer you as teachers and your students, if you can find a way to translate this into the classroom, a really powerful way of understanding exactly why the post-911 Constitution is going to, in its nature and extent, is going to be such a serious issue for us. Okay. So what I want to do now is revert to my normal role as an historian and just say something about the 18th century by way of explaining why I think the Bush administration's story about the nature of executive power is a myth, or it's based on a very misplaced and very problematic reading of our history, but why at the same time it may represent a very shrewd and very, indeed, a very accurate assessment of what the Constitution really means in operation. So on what basis can I say that it seems to me the administration position is a myth, does not accurately represent the way in which the presidency took shape at the time, or let's say as the culmination of the revolutionary constitutional experiment? So I have three kind of, several sets of major historical points here. I'm going to make, obviously under the time constraints, going to make them very briefly, but I want each of them to register with you because each one provides an important link in understanding the overall argument and the overall difficulty we faced. The first major point has to involve some understanding of what might be called the English or the British roots of American constitutionalism. Here, the key date and the key development and the key thing to be kept in mind is the meaning of the Glorious Revolution of 1688-1689. This, of course, is the events in England which lead to the deposition, the abdication, if you will, not the abdication, but the deposition of James II as King of England and his replacement by William of Orange, the Protestant prince from Holland, and his wife Mary, who was the daughter of James II. That's the genealogical background. The key thing to know about 1689 is it was all about curtailing the prerogative of the executive. It's all about curtailing the power of the crown. It's all about saying that the crown cannot make law of its own volition, of its own will. It's all about saying that in England and by extension America, the situation will not be like France. In France, the formula for adopting legislation is the king wishes it, le roi le veut. It's the king's will. The king wishes it. In England, in Britain, in colonial America after 1689, all law requires the assent of the people's duly elected representatives. That is the great principle that comes out of the Glorious Revolution. The king in England, in 18th century English practice, still has the authority to decide when the nation goes to war, and he still has the authority to make treaties, which don't have to be ratified by anybody. So the king retains some substantial power. But in other, I think, really critical ways, his authority, even in the areas of war and even in the areas of diplomacy, what we might call national security, were significantly curtailed. You know, I don't know how you spend your Christmas break, but I spent mine writing a brief in the Hamdan case, the Hamdan versus Rumsfeld case, which is the Guantanamo case, on behalf of a small group of historians, including a colleague from the University of Michigan. And one of the things I learned, which I had to go back and do some research here, is that the practice of regulating royal authority in the 18th century had two main, royal authority over war, over military affairs, had two main axes. One is a fairly familiar one. One is the idea that the king cannot keep up an army without the consent, in time of peace, without the consent of Parliament. And that's manifest in the principle of what's called annual supplies, which means that every year Parliament has to vote the revenues and the appropriations needed to keep the armed forces in being, needed to keep the army in being. What I had not known was that a similar principle applies in the realm of military justice. Every year from 1689 on, Parliament passes what's called a Mutiny Act. The original act was passed to help put down a mutiny, but subsequently this becomes the basis of military justice and for a whole array of administrative arrangements relating to the military. Parliament does this every year. In effect, it delegates authority to the Crown to maintain military justice, to do all a variety of other aspects of military administration. It firmly expresses the principle of civilian supremacy, indeed of the supremacy of Parliament over the king, even that area of war making, which had been so long thought of as part of the royal prerogative. So we start by understanding that the fundamental principle of the Glorious Revolution, which Americans believe in deeply, is that the king cannot make law of his own authority. The king cannot be an independent source of law. The executive cannot be an independent source of law. Everything lawful requires the assent of Parliament. It requires, that's to say, the direct assent of the people's representatives. That's my first major historical point. The second major historical point is that Americans share these attitudes quite deeply. American politics before 1765 is dominated or is deeply informed by an animus against executive power. In colony after colony, Americans repeat many of the great constitutional controversies that repeatedly rocked and roiled 17th century English politics. They are repeatedly claiming that, claiming and asserting and confirming that their own assemblies, their own legislatures should have the same rights, the same privileges, and the same oversight of executive power that have been true of the 18th century Parliament, or that have been, I should say, have been confirmed by the Glorious Revolution, and then have become the basis for 18th century parliamentary supremacy. So a deep notion that the executive is a subordinate power was already embedded in American politics before 1765. Then, of course, along comes the Revolutionary Controversy, by which I won't say anything, except, as we all know, it leads to the Declaration of Independence, an engraving of which from 1823 is part of the display here, as I'm sure many of you have seen already. And when Americans start writing new constitutions of government for each of the colonies which have now become independent states, the leading principle of those constitutions was to make sure that executive power was only executive power. Executive power in 1776 meant literally the duty and the authority to carry out, to implement, to execute what somebody else had decided. Executive power becomes merely that, or to use a phrase used by John Adams in a famous pamphlet called Thoughts on Government. Adams inserts the phrase, the executive, when stripped of those badges of domination, called prerogative. Prerogative in English history means, is always associated with the independent authority and the discretionary power of the crown. So this is the idea, when stripped of those badges of domination, called prerogative, that's what a Republican executive power would look like. It's a responsibility and a duty to carry out what somebody else has decided. So that's my second major point, is there's a deep anti-executive animus in American politics, in American constitutional thinking, at the time of the Revolution. It comes out of the Glorious Revolution. It's reinforced by colonial politics. It's manifested in our earliest constitutional documents with independence. Now, when we get to 1787, when we get to the adoption of the federal Constitution, it's true that there is a movement away from that weak executive, that weak conception of executive power that had been adopted or that had been the basis for constitutional thinking at the time of independence. The American presidency, as it's conceived by the framers at the Constitutional Convention of 1787, is a much stronger institution, and potentially a much more powerful institution than any of the analogous institutions, the comparable institutions within the states. The president is a much more, you know, the president from the get-go was conceived as a much more vigorous, a much more potentially potent office than any of the state governorships. Even so, if you track carefully, and it's one of the things I try to do in my book and some of my other writings, if you track carefully the evolution of the presidency in the Constitutional Convention, you cannot sustain the kind of broad claim for executive power or for the significance of the Commander-in-Chief Clause that the current administration claims for it. The kinds of decisions that went into the creation of the presidency were discrete decisions on very particular issues, and the kind of distribution of power that the Constitution affected represented as much an attempt to cabin, to confine, to restrict executive power as anything else. You know, it's always important to, you know, when you teach, to be able to pull the Constitution out of your pocket in case some obscure point comes up. So I want to just remind you of what the actual language of the Constitution is, that if you were a casual reader, if you did this as an exercise, if you asked your students, it might be a little tough in fifth grade, but I think by eighth grade and certainly by high school, you could ask them to do this. To sit and compare Article I, the congressional article, with Article II, the presidential article, and ask where do the framers expect responsibility to reside, you're not going to come up with a strong view of executive power. So I just want to remind you of some of the clauses that we find in Article I, Section 8, which is the enumeration of legislative powers. It's Congress, not the presidency, which has the authority to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations, the law of nations. Modern terrorism is an offense against the law of nations. It falls under the jurisdiction of Congress to determine what exactly that offense is, not as a matter of executive discretion. Congress also has the power to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. Captures on land and water would be a phrase capacious enough to embrace people captured in Afghanistan or any place else in the war on terror. The fact that Congress is given the power to issue letters of marque and reprisal, which basically authorizes privateers to go out and raid enemy ships, is itself significant. It says that even in this limited area of war making, the framers thought that the Congress should have the authority to determine when the nation's armed forces were to be committed, not the president. It's Congress that has the power to raise and support armies. It's Congress that has the power to provide and maintain a navy. It's Congress, significantly, has the authority to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces, which is the American equivalent of the Mutiny Acts from British tradition, British practice, that I just referred to. Against this, the president has the executive power, whatever that is, and his authority as commander-in-chief. You only make rules to, offense against the law of nations, you only make rules concerning captures on land and water. You don't make captures on land and water in time of peace, by definition. You make captures on land and water during time of war, which means that the president's authority as commander-in-chief does not give him the sole right to determine what is the basis upon which people can be captured and detained indefinitely, and so on. So as a matter, that the simple reading of the text, I think, should confirm the basic story of constitutional history that I'm trying to lay out here. So that's why I say, and the 2 or 3 minutes I suppose remaining to me, that's why I say that it seems to me the current, as a matter of constitutional history, as a matter of understanding the nation's roots, as a matter of understanding how the Constitution was written, what were the dominant prevailing attitudes at the time.
Many of them.
That's why it seems to me the position staked out by the current administration really is myth. Or really, it rests on a deeply inaccurate reading of the origins of the Constitution. But that doesn't make it wrong. It doesn't necessarily make it wrong. It doesn't necessarily make it the wrong reading of what the Constitution really means in practice. So here's my last concluding reflection on this. So I said there's a 5-year gap between when the Constitution was adopted and when we get this famous debate between Madison and Hamilton, writing anonymously for the newspapers. Madison is Helvidius and Hamilton is Pacificus. The issue in 1793 was whether or not the president's cabinet could issue a unilateral without calling Congress back into session, could issue a proclamation of neutrality determining the position of the United States vis-a-vis the war that had just broken out in Europe between revolutionary France and the reactionary monarchies of Europe, including, of course, Britain. Hamilton's position, Hamilton's position makes a lot of sense as a matter of policy, as a matter of expedition. Congress was not in session. The news arrives. The president has to make a decision. He can't wait for Congress to assemble. There's a lot to be said for Hamilton's position. What becomes controversial is that Hamilton says, in defending the president's policy, Hamilton also says that the executive power, embracing in the British conception the power of making war and making peace, that those powers are inherently executive in nature. And unless there are specific exceptions elsewhere in the text of the Constitution, the president has a wide range, has a wide discretionary authority to determine exactly what the nation should do. Madison and Jefferson they're not crazy about the policy, but they really object to the principle that Hamilton uses to justify it. And so Jefferson, as Secretary of State, drafts Madison, who's back home in Virginia in the recess of Congress, to write letters in response to Hamilton's doctrine. And what Madison says, in effect, is Hamilton's position could be true only if we had imported into our understanding of what we were doing this essentially British conception of the prerogative of the monarchy. That's exactly what we did not do, Madison says, Madison writes, in 1780, or what was not done in 1787, 1788. And if it had been done, if you had presented to the American people who had ratified the Constitution, they would never have accepted it. And quite possibly the Constitution would have been rejected on that basis alone. Madison was the better historian by far. Madison certainly had a much more accurate account of what had transpired in 1787, 1788. That's why when he writes these letters, he can quote a couple passages from Hamilton's Federalist essays back against Hamilton, which he does. But Hamilton, who was first and foremost a student of executive power, better understood all the advantages the executive enjoys in times of war. He better understood that because the executive power is vested in a single individual, it's easy for the executive to make a decision where it's cumbersome and difficult for Congress to do so. And, of course, the president has the authority to initiate action in a way that the judicial branch also does not. Judges have to wait for cases to make their way to them. We can denounce the activist judges, but judges still have to wait for litigants to come into their courts and to make their claims. So Hamilton understood that in any kind of serious situation, the executive always has had the advantage. That's what much of our history has confirmed. That's what I think, in some ways, the post-911 Constitution is in the process of confirming. I personally happen to think, as a matter of history, it's a very difficult reading of the Constitution to give the president the kind of authority he claims. I think our system of constitutional governance would be much better off if both the courts and Congress step up to the plate and do what they're supposed to do. But the executive has real advantages that Hamilton understood. And so this is one of those occasions where, even though the debate I've tried to encapsulate here took place more than 200 years ago, it turns out in its own way to be surprisingly relevant to things we're discussing today. But it's relevant at two different levels. Well, let's say there are two different kinds of history at work here. One is the history of how the Constitution was written. The other is the history of how it's evolved. And it's for us to decide which of those two histories tells a more compelling story for us. Thank you very much.